Let's start today by picking up where we were at the end of last time. We were explaining about the discovery of introns, the idea that eukaryotic genes have intervening sequences and that they don't affect the messenger RNA. And what I want to do today is discuss how those intervening sequences are handled. Now, we explained last time, and for this you really need 18C. If you didn't get, bring yours, it's over there. If this is our DNA, so this is double-stranded DNA, and the gene we're interested in starts here and ends here. And B is an intervening sequence, or an intron, while A and C are exons. Meaning that when we end up with a messenger RNA later on, and that's actually drawn over here, when we get the messenger RNA, it's going to have a sequence corresponding to the sense strand of A and a sequence corresponding to C, but it's going to lack the sequence corresponding to B. So the way this works, as we explained last time, is you transcribe the whole thing and then cut the intervening sequence or intron out of the transcript. So what's drawn on your handout is you transcribe the whole thing as one unit, meaning there's a promoter over here on the left, start transcription, and some kind of termination signal on the right. And that the RNA, as soon as it's made, is capped by the addition of a special structure, actually a modified G on the 5' end. We're not going to go into the details of this at all, although next semester we may a little bit more. And if you're interested in the structures, you can look them up in your book. And on the 3' end of the transcript, there is a string of A's added after transcription. And this is known as the poly-A tail. The possession of a cap and a poly-A tail is characteristic of almost all eukaryotic messages. But this isn't done in prokaryotes. Now, this RNA now has the information corresponding to the two exons, but also the information corresponding to the intron. So we've just done now transcription and modification of the RNA. And this is called the primary transcript. This RNA is not ready for prime time. It's not ready to be translated. It still has the intron in it. But now what's going to happen is this middle section is going to be cut out. Now, to show how that happens, in step 2, we haven't done anything except fold up the message, the RNA, to give you the picture. So it folds up something like this. And now it's time, it's ready for the catalyst in the cell to carry out the job of removing the intron. Now, these two sites here correspond to the ones here, and they're known as, they're named sort of from the point of view of the intron. That is, this is the 5' end, this is the 3', from the point of view of the intron. And they're also known as the 5', but this is known as the donor site and the acceptor. Because we are going to break off the intron and attach the 5' to the 3' and make a join. Now, when that happens, the RNA that was part of the intron is going to be released, and it's going to have a lariat form because of the mechanism. And I'm not going to go into why, but this is called a lariat. And this RNA is just going to be degraded, and the nucleotides are going to be reused. But the remainder now We've now connected exon 1 to exon 2. And we now have an RNA that is ready to be translated. It is now a proper messenger RNA. And now it can be translated. Now remember, this is all happening in eukaryotes, not in prokaryotes. In prokaryotes, the entire cell is one compartment. The DNA may be in one area of it, but there is no nucleus separated by a membrane. There is no subcompartment. But in a eukaryotic cell, in addition to being bigger, it has a subcompartment bounded by the membrane, the nucleus. And all the DNA is in the nucleus. And all of this transcription and splicing, as it's called, all this processing and splicing takes place in the nucleus. And it's only after it's finished that now the RNA goes to the cytoplasm and is translated. So everything I've drawn up here is happening in the nucleus. And now the finished RNA, which is now a proper message, can go to the cytoplasm and be translated. Now, to make it a little clearer how the translation goes, I've drawn the RNA again, the transcript, in that little box on the right. So we can see what some important features are. Now, where does translation start? The important part is it doesn't start right at the 5' end. Remember these untranslated regions. In eukaryotes, they're often extended. They're also often extensive. So translation starts somewhere in from the 5' end, usually at the first AUG or start codon. And translation stops wherever the stop codon is, leaving an untranslated 3' region and an untranslated 5' region on the RNA. So the only part that's actually translated is here. Now this is important because people say exons are the coding sequence. Exons include the coding sequence, but exons also include the untranslated regions fore and aft. The exons code for the part of the RNA that's going to end up in the message. Now, what does all of this? To do anything like this, you obviously need an enzyme or the equivalent. In the nucleus, there is a complex structure called a spliceosome. Now, the similarity in name to ribosome is intentional. A ribosome is not an RNA and it's not a protein. It's a complex of several RNAs and many proteins together, making up a ribonucleoprotein complex or particle. So a ribosome is an RNP, ribonucleic acid protein complex. So is a spliceosome. A spliceosome also contains both RNA and protein. And like the ribosome, some of the RNA in it has catalytic activity. So some of the RNA in a spliceosome is a ribozyme, meaning an RNA with catalytic activity. So the spliceosome aligns the exons properly relative to each other and then catalyzes the breaking off of the intron sequence to form a lariat, which can be degraded, and to join up the exons. And the fact that the spliceosome has catalytic, the RNA in the spliceosome has catalytic activity was actually proven by a graduate student in our department here at Columbia who was a TA for this course. And her name and a link to her work is in the is in your notes. Now we want to consider some of the implications of all of this. The first and obvious one has to do with the difference between eukaryotes and prokaryotes. We've mentioned that eukaryotic genes have introns, and prokaryotic genes do not. Now, not only do prokaryotic cells not have introns, but they also do not have spliceosomes. They lack the catalytic activity to remove introns, so they don't have any of their own. And if you put a DNA with introns into them, they can't handle it. Now, this has, no splicing machine. Now, that explains something we were talking about last time when we said there was a difference between the cDNA and the gene. The cDNA, which is the DNA copy of this, of the message, has no introns. The gene itself has introns. Now, when you're doing cloning, when you take a gene, and you put a human gene, say, or from any higher organism, and you put it into bacteria, into an expression vector, and you want the bacteria to make the corresponding protein, you can't start with this DNA. This DNA can be transcribed, but then the bacteria can't cut out the intron. So you have to use this version, the intronless version, to put into the bacteria if you want them to make the protein. So that's why when you clone a gene and put it into bacteria, you usually use the cDNA version, not the DNA version, the original, if you want the gene to make protein. Now, that's the practical application. What's the rationale? We don't really know, but we have an argument about why bacteria don't have introns and the ability to splice. And that's because they have only one compartment. As soon as a transcript is made in bacteria, ribosomes attach and start to translate it. So if this were bacteria, the ribosome would attach here and it would start translating before you could remove the intron. If you're going to remove introns or process your message, you have to have a compartment to do it in so that you can keep the RNA away from ribosomes until the RNA is ready to read. Eukaryotes can do that. Eukaryotes have a nucleus. They can make RNA, process it, and only ship to the cytoplasm what is ready to use. Bacteria have no place to shelter their message until it's ready, and so it makes sense that they don't have introns, they don't process their RNA, they just read it, either make it and read it or don't. Now, there's one other implication of all of this, which is quite important. The gene we drew up there has two exons and one intron. Most genes have many introns. So if I'm going to draw a gene now, just to keep it simple, I'm only going to put two introns in it. So there's a picture like this in your notes. And the gene then goes from here to here. It's conventional to use boxes to specify the exons like this. Now, this represents either the sense strand of the DNA or the RNA, which have the same sequence, 5 prime to 3 prime. How many introns does this gene have? What I'm really asking, is this an intron? It's not. This is a spacer between this gene and the next gene. An intron is within a gene. It's an intervening sequence, an intervening spacer, not just any old spacer. A spacer between genes is a spacer. A spacer inside genes is an intron. So this gene has two introns. Now, once you have more than one intron, there is more than one way to splice the primary transcript. So the obvious thing to do, and this is the way they always draw it, This is the symbol for splicing out intron 1. And this is splice out intron 2. And what you would end up with is a message that had the three exons connected to each other. But in eukaryotes, in higher eukaryotes, there's a lot of what is called alternate splicing. That means that the same gene is always transcribed to make the same primary transcript, but then the primary transcript can be spliced in more than one way. Now, you notice here, each of these is a 5' donor site. Each of these is a 3' acceptor site. So another alternative is to hook the first donor to the last acceptor and to skip the intron and the two introns and the exon and make it all into a super intron. So this is an alternative way to splice the transcript, and if you did that, you'd end up with a message that coded for a protein that had only A and C in it. This is not the same ABC as we had before. Now, it turns out that alternate splicing is extensive in higher organisms. And what's the implication of this? It means from a single gene, you can make a collection of related but non-identical proteins. And apparently, that's what happens in higher organisms. Different cell types splice the same transcript differently to make different variants of the protein. Or at different times in the life of a cell, the RNA is spliced in different ways. Next semester, we'll meet an example of this, which is very important in function. I just want to raise it now because this has been one of the major findings from the Human Genome Project. When the Human Genome Project was started, the scientists had a pool for people to guess how many genes would there be in the human genome. And the person with the lowest estimate won. We thought, we're the most complicated, right? We've got the most genes. Well, no way. We don't have that many genes more than a worm or a fly. But the difference is, from each of our genes, we can make multiple proteins by alternative splicing, and worms and flies do not. Now, you've all heard of the genome and the Genome Project, and genomics, which is the study of genomes. But there's also proteomics. There are a lot of ohms and omics. Genomics is the study of whole sets of genetic information. Proteomics is the study of the whole set of proteins that you get from the genome. Now the question is, which is bigger, the proteome or the genome? The proteome is much bigger. The collection of possible proteins is much larger in higher organisms than the collection of genes. And this is a surprise. People did not anticipate this. So it's not enough to know the sequence of the genome. You have to know what proteins are made for it and how the various transcripts are spliced. And this issue of alternate splicing is one of the things that's being studied in labs right now here in the biology department. And in fact, Dr. Chasen works on splicing, on what are the signals that tell the cell this is the place to do it. Now, I want to switch gears and talk about something else. So let me stop here and ask what questions you have about introns and splicing and so forth. Yeah.
Catalytic enzymes like the charging enzymes that are necessary for amino acid tRNA loading here in spliceosomes.
Are the same catalytic enzymes that charge tRNAs in spliceosomes? No. This is a totally different catalytic reaction and involves totally different catalytic activity, some of which is catalyzed even by RNA. This is a totally different business. Yeah? Is alternate splicing ever done concurrently? Well, there must be a time in the life of the cell when it's switching. But normally, and it is true that some cells will make a 90% one splice way and 10% the other. So it must be. Yeah.
Can you take genetic information that has introns in it, grow it in bacteria that can't make proteins in it, and then take it out from the bacteria and put it in the cell?
Yes. His question is, can you grow DNA with introns in bacteria? Sure. The enzymes of DNA replication don't know an intron from an exon. They just copy it all. But if you want it expressed, it's a different business. Yeah. How do you regulate protein synthesis from a gene that has introns? Now, I'm not sure what you mean, but one answer is just deciding to make the RNA or not is not enough. Is that what you mean?
Right.
Yeah, no, that's correct. You have to decide to make the RNA, and then you have to decide how to splice it. The whole business of regulation is much more complicated in eukaryotes than in prokaryotes. And we will talk about it in some detail next semester. And if you want to know the nitty-gritty, you can either go read it or take molecular biology. Yeah.
Can the order of the exons ever change?
Does the order of the exons ever change? No. Not in the same gene. DNA is DNA, and there it is. You always transcribe from one end to the other.
So even if you're skipping one?
Even if you skip, you don't mess around. No circles, no nothing. Yes?
So is this a primary reason they've discovered that there are introns, or are there other reasons that you haven't gone into that?
The question of why there is introns remains one that is not solved. There are suggestions as to why introns exist, but no one is absolutely sure. People are not sure whether bacteria are the descendants of things that had introns and they've dumped them, or they are primitive and have not developed introns. So people argue about all these things all the time, and no one is really sure. We can discuss maybe later the theories, or you can read them, but we're not going to go into it. Yes?
So if you have a mutation in a eukaryote, is that most likely
So what's a mutation in a eukaryote? A mutation is any change in the DNA that affects the functioning thereof. So one possibility is if you have a mutation in a gene that codes for a piece of the spliceosome doesn't work properly. But remember that most mutations, a mutation like that is going to affect the splicing of many messages and the production of many proteins. So those kinds of mutations, there's one like that in your problem set that affects protein synthesis. Mutations that affect the machinery for making other things tend to have global effects and be lethal. You already asked the question, so you have to wait. Okay, yeah?
So do mutations in the actual intron itself have no impact?
So what happens if you have a mutation in the intron itself? Sometimes it makes no difference whatsoever. And sometimes if it affects splicing, it makes a difference. Okay, one more, and then we're going to go on.
Is
cDNA made inside or outside the nucleus? Well, cDNA in viral infected cells, I think, is made in the cytoplasm, although I'm not sure. But cDNA is primarily made in laboratories, and so it's not an issue. In infected cells, I'm not sure. Okay, so I'm going to stop here. If people have additional questions, feel free to ask me after class, but I want to go on to the other subject. We find ourselves here talking about eukaryotes because when we looked at the results of genetic engineering using bacterial setups, we discovered introns. I actually want to talk most of the rest of the semester about eukaryotes because you could say, in a way, we've discussed most of the basic issues with prokaryotes. We haven't got to the end of it by any means, but we have discussed the basics of how one cell makes two. And now we want to ask for a eukaryotic cell. How does one make two? And then when we finish that, we want to ask for higher organisms. How does one make two? Now, it's not quite the right question because with higher organisms such as ourselves, the usual system is two make one. But the idea is the same. How do you do reproduction? But for today, we want to focus on cells. How does one eukaryotic cell make two? So we've got this basic picture here that we drew, which emphasizes one of the big differences. I think what we want to do today is we want to ask, what are the differences in structure between these two cell types, and how are we going to deal with those differences when it's time to do replication of the DNA and the cell? So what's the difference? Well, first of all, they clearly differ enormously in size and the amount of DNA they have. They obviously have a difference in where it is, one compartment or many. But I'm going to list the differences more or less in the order they are in your notes, although that isn't the most obvious ones from looking. That one of the big differences is how the DNA is arranged. That the number of DNA molecules in a prokaryote is what?
One.
You have a single chromosome, and it's a circle. So the number and shape in a prokaryote. What about in a eukaryote? There's clearly a lot more DNA, and it's divided into individual chromosomes. So there's always more than one piece in eukaryotes, usually many. We have 23 different pieces. Flies have 4. Some organisms have many more. Now, what's the shape? Each of those individual pieces in a eukaryote is not a circle, but it's linear. And we discussed briefly before that this makes for complications. Now, what about where it is? When we draw our pictures of bacteria, we usually draw the chromosome attached to the membrane. And in fact, it is. But in eukaryotes, most of the time, the DNA isn't attached to anything. And remember, attachment is what helps separate the two copies. Here we don't have a simple way of sorting out the two copies. Now, what about overall size? We've mentioned that the overall size of the total DNA in a eukaryote is generally much harder than in a prokaryote. What about the individual chromosome? It turns out that the individual chromosome in most eukaryotes, each of our 23, is the average one is larger than the entire bacterial chromosome. So this is about 3 times 10, 3 million base pairs. And this is more per chromosome. The average chromosome has more, and there are many of them. Now, the fact that the chromosomes are longer is a problem, because you have to get the DNA copied in a reasonable amount of time. And if the chromosome is too long, it's going to take too long for the fork to move down. And in fact, it's worse, because the fork moves more slowly in eukaryotes. The DNA polymerase complex moves more slowly down the DNA. So getting these chromosomes done in time is going to be an issue as well. And we've already noted that where the DNA is there a separate compartment or a nucleus? And of course, prokaryotes, no. Eukaryotes, yes. Now, there's one other feature you have to know about that's important in reproduction and replication. The DNA in the chromosomes of eukaryotes is packaged in a very specific way with a set of special proteins called histones. And they are missing in prokaryotes. So this means that when the cell copies its DNA, it also has to make a whole new set of histones, and it has to put it all together properly. It's not enough to just replicate the DNA, which is the primary issue in prokaryotes. So how do cells deal with this issue? How is the system set up so eukaryotes, one cell can make two, and properly divide up the genetic material, even though there are many different chromosomes, linear, long, and in a nucleus and with histones? And the answer to this is what I call the two-state solution. And we're not talking the Middle East here. We're talking about cells. So cells, eukaryotic cells, when they have a state for when they are not dividing and a state for when they are dividing. So they have two states, one of which is set up for doubling everything and getting it ready, and a second state for taking it all and distributing it properly. So you could say this one is not dividing. This is specialized for synthesis. This one is for dividing and specialized for distribution. Now, when the cell is not dividing between divisions, it's said to be an interphase. It has a well-defined nucleus and cytoplasm, and the DNA histone combination is relatively stretched out. It's still double-stranded, it's still supercoiled. The issue here is whether it's supercoiled or whether it's super, 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 duper coiled. So it's a little the difference between here you have kite string unreeled, but when it's time for distribution, you have to pull in the kite string, wrap it up neatly, and have it in packages so you can divide it all up. So in this stage, the DNA histone complex is relatively loose, and it's known as chromatin. But when the cell is going to divide, each individual piece, remember there are multiple pieces or multiple chromosomes, each piece is pulled out and wrapped up neatly. And you can see individual chromosomes, which I've drawn here. And the DNA is the histone DNA complex is relatively tight. Now, the importance of that is, remember, this is the synthesis phase. The DNA is relatively stretched out. The enzymes can get to it. They can replicate it and transcribe it. But in this stage, the DNA is so tightly wound up that the enzymes can't use the information in it. So that's important. It can't be used as a template. So we ask, what about replication and transcription can occur here when it's relatively loose, but not when it's relatively tight? So it's template function, distribution function. Now, you notice there's no nuclear membrane in the picture on the right. The nuclear membrane comes apart into pieces which are pushed aside during division. So I'll just draw it like this. The pieces are still there, but they don't form a structure that confines the chromosomes. Now, the nuclear membrane is assembled here and disassembled in division. Now, it turns out there are a bunch of proteins in the cell which are rearranged at different times in the cell's life. One of them is the proteins of the nuclear membrane. They're held together to form a lipid envelope during interphase, but during division, they are taken apart and pushed aside. There's another set of proteins that do something that's reverse. There's a bunch of proteins that make up what are called microtubules. Exactly how they work, we'll talk more about later, next semester. But these can form different networks. And during interphase, they are arranged one way. And then they rearrange during division. And they form what is called the spindle. So they form fibers which connect to the chromosomes and also to structures at the poles. These are called spindle fibers. During interphase, they're usually called microtubules, but the microtubules make up the spindle fibers, which is what they're called during division. And these spindle fibers now are attached to the chromosomes and are going to help move them around. So this solves the sort of attachment sorted out problem. Now, we've discussed the two states here, but of course a cell has to go back and forth from one to the other. How does that work? That is referred to, how a cell does it is referred to as the cell cycle. If a cell finishes division, it's a small cell, and it's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and then it's going to divide again. And then those small cells are going to do it again. So that's why they call it a cycle, and it's usually written this way. This is division or mitosis. When the cell is in the stage with chromosomes, and the rest of it is interphase, when the DNA is in the chromatin state. So when a cell has just finished division, it's pretty small, and it gets bigger and bigger until eventually it's double size. And then the double size cell will rearrange its DNA, spindle fibers, etc. You'll see visible chromosomes. The cell will divide, and now you'll have two small cells, and they'll go around again. So this illustrates time much as it does on a clock. And some typical times for this cycle for eukaryotic cells are in your notes. Something like 24 hours is more like it. Bacteria go through a whole cycle in a very short time. Now, can you, let me just say, when can you see chromosomes? Only in this stage of the cycle, in mitosis, can you see visible chromosomes. The rest of the time, the DNA is relatively stretched out and it's visible as chromatin only. Now, can you divide up the cell cycle more? You can. During interphase, you're piling up protein, RNA, DNA, etc., but you can actually divide it up into three parts. That all of the DNA replication takes part in a place part of the middle, which is called S for synthesis. You might think that cells would start replicating their DNA right away, and it would take them this whole time to double it, and then as soon as the DNA was finished, they would divide. But it doesn't work that way. Cells spend a certain amount of time gearing up, and only then do they replicate their DNA in a relatively short period. And then they spend a certain amount of time tying up things, finishing things, getting things ready, and only then do they divide. So this period, when there is no DNA synthesis before the period, is called G1 or GAP1. And the period after DNA synthesis, before the cell divides, is called GAP2 or G2. So the cell cycle is traditionally divided into G1, S, and G2, which are parts of interphase, and M, or division. Now, for in adult tissues, G1 is the most variable. And the regulation of this whole system involves largely the switch here, the passage from G1 to S, and that's discussed in your books, but we're going to put that off until next semester. What I want to consider now, though, is how do we know that DNA is only made here, and it's not made before and after? Well, it turns out that you can synchronize cells. There are drugs that will cause cells to hold up at some point in this cycle, usually at metaphase. And so you can collect a lot of cells at metaphase and then release the block. And the cells will all go around together in synchrony. Now, if you have cells at this point and you supply radioactive T, what do you think happens to it? Does it get made into DNA? No. If you supply radioactive T here, it is not made into macromolecules. It just lies around. If you supply radioactive T here in S, it's made into macromolecules. If you supply radioactive T to these cells, they don't do anything with it. It just lies around. So that's how we know that cells only make DNA here. If you supply radioactive T in G1 or G2 or M, Nothing happens to it. But if you supply radioactive T and S, it's made into macromolecules. And T, of course, goes only into DNA. So we know that DNA is made in S. Now, I have a question for you. We've just said that T, to use the lingo, is only incorporated in S. What if you were to use U or amino acids? You supply radioactive U or radioactive amino acids, and you ask, are they incorporated into macromolecules in G1, S, G2, or M? What goes in here, yes or no? So I want you to try that. Try that one, and then we will see how we do. Incorporate U into macromolecules in G1? How many people say no? Yes. Well, the yeses have it, but there are a significant number of no's. What about S? Yes? Yes. No. Evenly divided. Nobody knows. G2. Do you get U into RNA? How many yes? How many no? A few. People are not quite sure about G1, G2, but the majority opinion seems to be that you can incorporate U in G1 and G2, meaning you're making RNA in G1 and G2. You are. What about during M? How many people say yes? How many people say no? Well, almost everybody says no, and this time I have to agree with you. It's straightforward, because can RNA polymerase get to the DNA in M? Remember, the DNA is all very tightly wound up. So, in fact, you cannot use DNA as a template either to make DNA or RNA in M. Can you make protein in M? Would amino acids be incorporated? Well, it depends if there's RNA lying around. If messenger RNA is still there, you can't make new message, but if the message is still there, you can make protein. It turns out you can make protein in all of these. Because remember that protein, that messenger RNA doesn't necessarily have a short half-life in higher organisms. In higher organisms, some of the RNAs lie around. So if they last a long time and they're here at any point, you can make protein off of them. So probably most of the protein is made in G1, S, and G2, but a little of it is made in M. Now, come back to this question. People were not sure about S. During S, the DNA is being used to make DNA. It's replicating. Can you transcribe it at the same time? Well, the answer is you can. And one of the reasons you can, probably, is that not every piece of the DNA is being replicated at the same time. And it's possible that the pieces that aren't being replicated can be transcribed. But it also seems possible, although it's not clear why, that RNA polymerase and DNA polymerase can work without too much interference with each other. So it turns out that you can make RNA in S, although it's not obvious that you should be able to. So you can make RNA, you can incorporate U anytime in interphase, but not in M. And you can incorporate amino acids in any time, but probably less in M. Because M is specialized, mitosis, for distribution and not for synthesis. So now I want to look at how you actually double the chromosomes and form them so you can divide things up. Now, if you want to look now briefly at 19A in that little box. see in that little box, we've drawn chromosomes two ways. We draw a chromosome like this, and a chromosome like this, and often people just draw an X. So clearly, this is what a chromosome would look like before S. This is what it would look like after S. There's only one problem. Can you see chromosomes? No, you can't. They'd be all stretched out, and you wouldn't be able to tell which one you had. But in fact, you could say at the very beginning of the cell cycle, somewhere around here, when chromosomes start, you should be able to tell that they're double. And over here by the end, after you've divided everything up, they should be single. And you can indeed see that. But how does this relate to DNA? Single-stranded, double-stranded, etc. To make that clearer, you want to look at the bottom of B. And now we've redrawn them, and we've redrawn them in the other direction. I've just rotated them 90 degrees, which is what I've done here. I've rotated like this. Okay. Whenever we draw a line, that represents a double-stranded DNA molecule. So maybe we should write it like this. This is a chromosome, which has before DNA replication. If you could see it, this is what it would look like. Or this is what it would look like at the end of division. But now, after you go through S, and you double everything, and you get ready for division again, now the chromosome has to be doubled. So how does that work? DNA replication is semi-conservative. So each of these is going to come apart, and we're going to make a complement. And just to make it clear, we'll make one of them darker. I guess the new one is darker. Now, how do these two relate to each other and to the original? Are these two the same? In sequence? You don't seem sure. Well, you had semi-conservative DNA replication. So Watson and Crick separated, and Crick made a new Watson, and Watson made a new Crick. So now that I say that, what's the relationship? They're the same. They're identical. How do they relate to this one? They're the same, too. So we just made a copy. It's not quite right to say we made a copy because we don't have a new one and an old one. Each copy, quote unquote, is half old and half new because of semi-conservative DNA replication. But the sequence in here, and in there is the same. Now, these two remain connected. And the part where they're connected is called the centromere. It's a special region of the DNA, and there's actual protein gluing it together. So this whole thing is the centromere. Now, the connection doesn't have to be in the middle. The connection could be at the end, in which case, it would look like this. But in both cases, our chromosome now has two identical halves. This is a chromosome. And this is a chromosome. What's the difference? You could say I'm stupid to call them both chromosomes, but they are. They're both called chromosomes, whether it's doubled or whether it's single. So how are you going to keep that straight? This half is called a chromatid. So what we have just said is that a chromosome, how many chromatids does a chromosome have? Some said one and some said two. Depends when in the cell cycle you are. It depends where you are. A chromosome can have one chromatid, that's this case, single chromosome, or a chromosome can have two chromatids. But as long as they're still held together by a centromere, it's called one chromosome. Now, the rationale behind that is these two chromatids are identical. We want to keep track that this is two copies of the A to B volume. They're not different. They're the same. And when I make descendants, one descendant should get one of them, and one descendant should get the other. And this is a way of keeping track that they're copies. Now, these are often called sister chromatids to indicate that they're identical. Some people consider this sexist. I say women don't get enough press. It's fine. But you can call them whatever you want. You can call them sibling chromatids. You can call them identical twin chromatids. You can call them whatever you want, as long as you realize that they are the same. Now, I brought a model for some of this. It's more fun than anything else, but okay. This is a toy called Bend It. So this would be an unreplicated chromosome with one chromatid. This would be another one, another one, another one. All of these would be chromosomes that have only one chromatid. But this would be now a replicated chromosome that has two chromatids connected at the centromere. Now, I brought three of them to indicate that the centromere can be in the middle, it can be on the end, so you get X-shaped or V-shaped, or it can be not quite at one end, but sort of nearer one end than the other. All of these are possible. And that is one of the ways you tell one chromosome from another, is by its size and the position of the centromere. Now, after DNA replication, and after tightening up ready to roll, the chromosomes all look doubled. But now we have to divide up the goods. We've doubled the genetic information, and we have to divide it into the two daughter cells so each one gets a complete set. How is that done? That is the process of mitosis, and that is on handout A, again, 19A. Now, I gave you all four handouts because it's not quite clear which ones we'll need today, and this one you'll need again tomorrow. So, I don't mean tomorrow, I mean Tuesday. So, what you should do is bring them all back next time, but for now, we're going to go over the mitosis part of A, of 19A. So before you can do any replication of any kind, the DNA has to be replicated or doubled, and that happens in interphase. So that's the very beginning, you could say. You can't see anything happening here, but you go through S phase, the DNA doubles, the histones are made, everything's put together. Now, in division, each individual chromosome is wound up tightly. And division is said to begin when you can see individual chromosomes. And at this point, the nuclear membrane starts to break down, and you see individual chromosomes. And I've just drawn two here to make it simple. And this is called prophase. Now, you can see from looking here that I've drawn each chromosome with two chromatids. And when you examine cells in the microscope, sometimes they look like this. But sometimes, because of the way you do it, the two sister chromatids stick together tightly. So sometimes it doesn't look like they're doubled. This is why people were not sure when the DNA was doubled. Because when they looked at chromosomes in prophase, they couldn't tell. Because the two sister chromatids were very tightly stuck to each other, and they just sort of looked like one chromatid. You couldn't tell. You couldn't tell one from two. But we now know that, in fact, you have two chromatids per chromosome at the beginning of division in prophase. And so we usually draw chromosomes like this. Now, how are we going to divide things up? When we get daughter cells, what are they supposed to get? One of each? I mean, they're supposed to get either the wiggly or the straight? No, they're supposed to get half a wiggly and half a straight. So on some plane in the cell, which I'm going to draw as the equator, but it could be anywhere. Let's say the plane we're talking about goes through the equator. We're going to line up all the chromosomes. And then we'll be able to take one chromatid one side, one chromatid the other side, and divide everything up. So you notice I've gotten them lined here, wigglies straight. You have 46 chromosomes in each of your cells, 23 kinds, two of each. And all 46 would be spread out on this plane. Now, there's no spindle fibers written in your picture, but there actually are spindle fibers here attached to the poles. And these spindle fibers are going to pull the chromatids to one end or the other, because this is called metaphase when you line everything up. What's going to happen now is, what's holding the two halves of the chromosome together? It's the centromere. It's that protein. And that protein now comes apart so that the two chromatids separate. But remember, each chromatid is attached to a spindle fiber, and the spindle fibers shorten and pull. So when they pull, the chromosomes form either Vs or J-type things, depending on where the centromere was. In the picture you have, the centromere is not exactly in the middle, but closer to one end. And so your separating chromosomes look like this, because we're actually pulling with the fibers on the position of the centromere. But the centromere itself has split, and this is called M phase. Now, I've divided the genetic material up properly, but now I have to put the cell back into the other state. I have to allow it to reform, each half, to reform a nucleus, stretch out the chromosomes so they can be read, etc. So the next stage is called telophase. And the cell starts to split. Exactly how that happens depends on whether this is a plant cell or an animal cell. We won't go into the fine points. But the chromosomes start to stretch out, and the nuclear membrane starts to reform. Looks sort of like prophase, but it's going in the other direction, and they're smaller. And then in the final stage, the cells separate completely. The nuclear membrane reforms completely. The chromosomes stretch out all the way, and it just looks like chromatin. And these are daughter cells. How does the genetic information in the daughter cells compare to the genetic information in the original? Is it the same? Well, think about it. Yes. It is, because in each chromosome went through semi-conservative replication, and then one of the chromatids went to one daughter cell and one went to the other. And so as a result of this process, you have two cells with exactly the same genetic information as the original. Now, are there questions about this before I go on? Yeah.
Could they actually freeze prophase and then denature?
It's not the DNA strands, it's the chromatids. Okay, ask me later. Okay. Yeah?
Do none of these processes happen in binary fission?
Do any of these processes happen in binary fission? No. So the way prokaryotes divide does not involve any of this mechanism. But remember, when you have binary fission, you have only one circular chromosome. You make two copies of it, and one has to go to each. But in the average eukaryotic cell, you don't have just two chromosomes. You have 50 or 40. So it's a much more complicated business, because you have 40 different ones. And you have to be sure that when you copy this one, one copy goes to here, one copy goes to here. When you copy the next one copy goes to there, one copy. Okay. Yes?
How is the nuclear membrane broken down?
Now, we have ignored an enormous amount here, but during this process, various changes, enzymes are made or activated, which in turn alter these proteins slightly so that their stickiness changes. and the process is reversed at the end. It actually involves considerable phosphorylation and dephosphorylation of proteins, and we'll talk about some of that next semester. Yeah?
Chromosome, is the centromere always at the same location?
In a particular chromosome, is the centromere in the same location? Yes. Because there's some specific DNA sequence at which this protein sticks and the spindle fibers stick. It's always the same place. Okay. So what I want to consider now is a sort of phenomenon that takes advantage of cell division to actually look at the chromosomes. Do they always have the centromere in the same place? How would you know that? So remember we said earlier that there are drugs which will arrest cells at this stage of the cycle. So you can trap cells at this stage. Now one of the advantages of this stage at metaphase is that remember that all the cells are spread out, all the chromosomes are spread out on a single plane. Now that plane might be here, but wherever it is, all the chromosomes are spread out. So what people do is they squash the cells, literally, squish. Now when you squash the cells, some of them will be oriented, so their plane was this way. And when you squash them, and then you take a photograph from the top, you see all the chromosomes spread out. And that allows you to get a picture with all of the chromosomes. So you want to look at B, which has a sample squash on it, somewhat idealized. We have here four squashes. The same picture is in your notes in color, which is a little easier to understand. Now we have here four squashes. And in these cases, just from looking at the squash, you can sort of get the picture. Human cell, there are 46 chromosomes. So looking at a squash can be pretty confusing. So what's customary to do is using either paper and scissors or using computer technology, what you essentially do is cut out each of the chromosomes. And then you arrange them in a pattern from biggest to smallest. So this is called a squash, because that's what it is. And when you arrange them in a pattern, it's called a karyotype. So, for example, from this cell, it would be like so. And the karyotype of the next cell would look like this, four of them. And the karyotype of the next cell would look like this. Now, the karyotype is specific to each species. So all humans virtually have the same karyotype. All chimpanzees have the same karyotype, which incidentally is not very different. And all fruit flies have the same karyotype and so forth. They have a characteristic number of chromosomes and a characteristic number of copies of each one. So in this case, for example, there are four different kinds of chromosomes. Here there's only one. Here there are two. This number, the number of kinds, is traditionally known as N, capital N. So here it would be 4, 1, 2. Now the other thing you can notice is how many of each kind. For example, here there's one of each kind in the first example. Here there is four of each kind. Here there are two of each kind. So this is known as the ploidy, because they're known as haploid, diploid, triploid, etc. And the cell that has one of each kind is said to be haploid. Probably should be monoploid, but that's historically what it's called. Those that have four of everything are called tetraploid. And those that have two of everything are called diploid. Since this is the normal state for your body cells and that of every other higher organisms, diploid is the standard. Haploid is half of that, and I think that's where the name came from. Now, all of your body cells are diploid. Only your gametes, your eggs and sperm, are haploid. An example of tetraploid is Easter lilies. many plants are tetraploid, hexaploid, etc. You can't do it with animals. With animals, you make it tetraploid, you don't get a bigger pig. But with lilies, if you make them tetraploid, you get a bigger flower, and that's what they are. Now, what about humans? Just to compare. Your ordinary body cells are diploid. You have two of everything. But the number of kinds you have is 23. So that means there's a total of 46 chromosomes. There's two of each. Okay. Now, the important thing to realize here is the number of chromosomes in these cells is all the same. The number of chromosomes is the number of kinds, that's the number of copies, and it's 4. But this cell is haploid. It's said to be N. This cell is tetraploid. It is said to be 4N, but N is 1 here, and N is 4 there. And this cell is also diploid, or 2N, and so is this one. So now I have a question for you. What is the relationship between, say, some of these pieces? If you have a chromosome that looks like this, or you have two chromosomes that look like that, what is related to what? So how is this related to that, or this to that, or these two to each other? So I want you to think about that for a minute. Now, what does each of those lines mean? Single-stranded DNA or double?
Double.
It means double. So what's the relationship between those various parts and pieces? But we're obvious, I wouldn't ask. If this is a standard chromosome, what is the relationship between these two? Is there any? No, there isn't. But what about these two? Are they the same? They should be, because this is the result of semi-conservative DNA replication. These should be the same, and they're just connected at the centromere. But if you look at a human cell and you see two of these, how are they related to each other? Do you have a word for it? Have you ever heard of it? Will some brave soul want to say what that word is? I heard it. Homology. These are homologous chromosomes, or homologs. Now, what do we mean by that? Let's draw a chromosome like this. It has some series of genes on it. Let's say gene 1, gene 2, gene 3, gene 4. Now, let's draw a homolog. Now, these two are after DNA replication, but the two chromatids of each one are the same. So I'm going to reduce it to this case. So how are these two related? If I have, say, the gene for musical ability, but let's suppose, and the gene for perfect pitch, but that probably doesn't exist either. The gene for nose length, the gene for number of toes, and the gene for eye color. So what have we got over here? We've got the same ones in the same order, but are they necessarily the same? No, because we could have the allele for perfect pitch over here and the allele for the tone deaf allele over here, so to speak. Okay? These are going to be alleles of the same gene, but not necessarily the same. So they are the same gene, but not necessarily the same version. And here we're going to have gene 4 and another copy of gene 4. Maybe they're the same, maybe they're not. Okay, so these are homologous. They are not the same. So here, to go back again, these two sister chromatids are the same. These two sister chromatids are the same. But this chromosome is homologous to this chromosome. So in a diploid, you have pairs of homologs. In a haploid, you have only one of each type. Now, when you look at a human karyotype, you can't tell all the chromosomes apart just by looking at size and position of centromere. Some of the chromosomes look very similar, like you'll have four that look like this. Now, clearly, two of these are homologous, and the two others are homologous, but this isn't enough information. When you do karyotypes, there is a technique for treating the chromosomes with chemicals and dyes so that they take on a banded appearance. Different procedures give you different bands. They correspond either to differences in tightness and looseness along the chromosome, differences in AT and GC along the chromosome, but for these purposes, we don't care. All we care is they give you a characteristic banding pattern so that one will look like this. Let's say these two have that pattern, but the other two, although they're the same size and have the same position of the centromere, they give you a very different banding pattern. So banding allows you to tell one chromosome from another so that you can unambiguously say which are homologs and which are not. Now, if everything worked by mitosis, we would have an issue. Now, I think you all know about the birds and the bees, or what we mean by that anyway. I have two children, and each of them was formed from one cell from me and one cell from my husband, and I have to admit, in the usual way. And when you tell children about how it's done, they always say, well, yeah, but not my parents. So if we took one cell from me and one cell from my husband, my children should have 92 chromosomes. But I know they don't, because I did an amniocentesis, so I know they don't. They have 46 chromosomes, I have 46 chromosomes, and my husband has 46 chromosomes. So this means something else is going on. When I made eggs, in those eggs, you didn't have 46 chromosomes. What you had to have was one of these, one of these, one of these, etc. One from each homologous pair. My husband made sperm with one of each homologous pair. In other words, the gametes are haploid. And when you put them back together again, you get a diploid. And this not only allows you to keep the chromosome and the karyotype constant from cell to generation, but it also allows for reshuffling of the genetic information. Because my children have part from me and part from my husband. So this requires that there be another kind of cell division in which you don't just copy everything and take one of everything, in which you copy everything, but you take only one of these, one of these, one of these. Now you start the same way. You start with doubled chromosomes, so it's even more complicated. You have to take one of these four chromatids, one of these four chromatids, etc. And so starting with this, you're going to have to end up with four cells instead of two, and they're going to be haploid instead of diploid. And that process is called meiosis. And what we will do next time is we will look at meiosis, compare it to mitosis, and also look at karyotypes in more detail. Now notice that my office hours today are in another room because I couldn't get, this is the only one I could get, 900 Fairchild.